I'm Cassidy.
And I am Jamie.
And this is another episode of Travel with a Chance of Murder. And we're well into season two now.
Yeah, I think we're doing relatively well. We're trying to get a fair amount of countries under the belt, keeping you guys updated with decent content.
How are you feeling, Jamie? Are you feeling like a full-fledged podcaster now that you've gotten four or five episodes underway?
I'm going to be honest, Cassidy. Originally, I thought it'd be just something to do to pass the time, but now I'm actually going to put the links to these this playlist on my Instagram and stuff, and I'm like a full claimed podcaster on Travel with a Chance of Murder. Now, I am aware that you have a hat that says Travel with a Chance of Murder on it, and if possible, if they're still in production, I would like to request one of those hats.
Yeah, we can get you some branded merch so you can fully
that is what I live for.
So this week we're going to Israel, which is super exciting for the two of us because we both were there pretty recently. So Jamie is gonna fill you in on all of the hot tips and tricks because he was only there two or three weeks ago.
Yeah, but two or three weeks ago you went, and then a week or two later I went. I feel that we experienced different things in Israel, and at the same time some of the similar things, so it was quite interesting to have a little discussion on the things that we both did, as well as look at the things that we separately did.
Yeah, I'll actually be able to chime in and know things for once on this. Yeah. When you're like, do you know this?
Yeah, so I think we should do the customary 3-2-1 and see what we think kind of rings our bell with the word Israel, and give our viewers, even though they're listeners, a chance as well to have a little think about what they get from the word Israel.
I feel like we'll actually be on the same page on this one too. There's been a couple recently where we're like spot on. I think this will be one.
Yeah, I think so as well, but let's just see. Do you want to do the countdown?
Yeah, I haven't done the countdown in a few weeks. All right. You have your word in mind. You're good to go.
Yes.
Okay. 3-2-1 Bible.
Religion. Okay. So I've went for multiple religions and you've went for Christianity. So there's a reason why Israel is called the land of creation, and that's their tourism slogan. So it's one of the most fascinating countries in the world, both geographically and culturally. It's the birthplace of religions like Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. It's a country in the Middle East, located east of the Mediterranean Sea. It's bordered to the north by Lebanon, to the northeast by Syria, to the east by Jordan, southwest by Egypt, and by the west, obviously, the Mediterranean Sea. And then within Israel, there's a few border things going on with the Palestinian territories, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Now, although Israel is a small country, it's got a relatively diverse topography, consisting of lengthy coastal plains, highlands in the north and the central regions, and the Negev Desert in the south.
Yeah, our tour guide was saying it's only 7 hours from the top to the bottom of Israel, and I did not get to explore that much of it. I think we were on the bus for 2 hours, but it was really cool to see the different areas of Israel turn from these giant banana farms to the big mountains to the water. I thought it was all desert. I thought it's the Middle East as well. It's not going to have any kind of farmland. But they are so self-reliant. They have so many different farms. The amount of banana fields I saw was so cool.
Yeah, I completely agree. Whenever I went there, I thought it would just be desert. But it's really interesting how green and grassy it is. And like you said, it's because they've had to be so so self-reliant. You know, you've got these huge farms that are growing bananas and olives and other...
Yeah, the olive and fig trees.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on. And although, yeah, you're correct in them saying they have to be self-reliant, it's also related because of the diverse climate they have because of the Great Rift Valley, which we looked at in our Kenya episode. Now, the Great Rift Valley, the northern part of it is situated in Israel. So that it's pretty, just shows from last episode how big the Great Rift Valley is, and that encourages easier different climates.
That is massive. That is so big that it stretches from Kenya to Israel.
So as you know, my part of the podcast is giving a little bit of history, culture, and some things to do in the country. And I could have, like every country, spent tons of episodes talking about the history and the culture of the particular country. However, the history of Israel is just astronomically huge. We couldn't even touch on it. So I'm going to give you a very, very brief synopsis as usual.
Shame that I couldn't find a ton of stories. If I had better luck finding stories, we could have done a two-parter.
Yeah, well, that's why I find quite interesting that there's so much history and so much to talk about that I was confused that you couldn't find many, many horror stories and many true crime stories about it.
I'm wondering if I struggled because it's all Hebrew, because there's a lot more Hebrew than I expected. And I mean, obviously that comes from a very North American, English is my first language. We all speak English expectation, which is not accurate for the rest of the world. But I'm wondering if like all the news and stuff is just reported in Hebrew. And so that's why I couldn't find anything as easily, because I'm searching in English instead of trying to maybe translate the word true crime into Hebrew and then type it in the browser. I don't know.
I found it really difficult to communicate with people because I found that there was very little people speaking English, and there's very little signage and stuff in English. What did you find?
The signs are all in Hebrew. Everything I saw, like nothing was in English. All the bus stops, all the signage on the public transportation was like all Hebrew. I didn't really ask too many people for directions or anything. All Hebrew that I saw.
Yeah, I find that quite interesting that you've got Israel that have kept their roots. And it is because they've got such a deep knitted culture and history. Now, much of what we know about ancient Israel is from scholars in the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh. Now, the Tanakh is made up of three parts, if you will. And the first one is called the Torah, which is in the Christian Old Testament. So according to the text, Israel was the region colonized by Abraham whenever he left Ur, and is considered to be the father of Judaism through his son Isaac, and Islam through his son Ishmael. Now, the land was developed by his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob. Jacob, who later changed his name to Israel. Now, this land was owned by King Israel, brackets, Jacob. And that is why it's called Israel. It's got a complex history with periods of peace and conflict for thousands and thousands of years. Now, there's a lot more I can get into about the history of Israel and the 12 tribes of Israel and where Israel came from and stuff like that. But we're glossing over a fair bit of it. So the nation of Israel, the current nation of Israel, it's got a population of roughly 9 million people. Most of them are Jewish, and has many important archaeological and religious sites considered sacred by Jews, Muslims, and Christians alike. And for me, personally, that's what I found very interesting about Israel. It's not just one religion. There's many religions there that all have roots to this location. Because of this, the history is complex, it's diverse, and there is periods of peace, but at the same time, periods of conflicts that has happened over thousands of years.
I think it's cool, too, that like not only do they share a history, but they're like places of importance to each one of those groups. Because I think you can say there's lots of places around the world that might share histories with different countries because one country came and conquered the other. And so there was this group and then there was this group, but they're not necessarily very many places that share that like mm-hmm. deep-rooted importance of higher significance.
Well, this is it. This is, it's because of the location of Israel. Now, Israel is situated in a prime, it's called like a passage location. To the southwest, you've got Egypt. And to the northeast, you've got the Assyrians. Now, these are huge empires from prehistory who would have to go through Israel to battle each other and stuff like that. But Israel has always been on the border of these huge empires that are at war with each other. And it's always been a trade route from these empires as well, from the east through to the Mediterranean. So there's a lot of desire to control this area, which over time these civilizations embedded their culture, their history, their religion.
Right, because it's a port city. So that makes sense that a lot of people and places would have been kind of stopping through because it's right on the water.
Exactly. It's been a prized possession for many empires. So, you know, the Romans had it, you know, but before that, there was different empires. So, the Romans had it, then the Byzantines had it. Before falling under the control of the fledgling Islamic Caliphate in the 7th century. Although the object of dispute during the Crusades, the region then generally known as Palestine remained under the sway of successive Islamic dynasties until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. So it's been through thick and thin for a very long time. It's only been up, Israel as a country itself has only existed since 1948 when it was placed under British mandate from the League of Nations after World War II. I do tread lightly on going into some of the history of Israel in order not to offend anyone. And as discussed earlier in the podcast, the history and the culture is so rich and so diverse that we can go into a rabbit hole. And I obviously am not an expert in some of these things, and I don't want to
I think that's fair.
But anyway, let's put a fair amount of that under the rug. And let's get straight into some of the awesome things that you can do in Israel.
Yes, my favorite part.
Let's go. Now, before I say a few of these things, if you do plan to go to Israel, please do go with a tour guide on a guided tour. There are places, unfortunately, where there is conflict and there is violence still. And the last thing you want to be is going to the wrong border check, not knowing when you're going. So it is just safer. If you're going to anywhere near the border, like Bethlehem or Jerusalem, please go on a guided tour.
It's just better to know what you're looking at too. There's exactly. So much history and background. Like Jamie said, it could take him like 3 episodes to cover everything. So it's a lot better to have someone who can explain to you like what you're looking at, why it's important, what it's been through, maybe some of the battles it's survived and all that really interesting fun facts that you can tell your family and friends and they go, oh my gosh, your life is so cool.
100%. There's so much things that tour guides can offer you that you just don't grasp because you just don't know it. The first place we're going to go to is Jaffa. Ooh, Cassie, you've been to Jaffa. What was your experience with Jaffa?
I went there twice. So I went there on my scooter. I took an electric scooter from where I was staying on one side of the port area and the beach and took it all the way up. And then on my last day, I went and I jumped on a bus and I fully explored it. But when I was visiting, it was so rainy that it was not the most fun for exploring because I was just caught in downpour after downpour. Didn't have an umbrella. My jacket was not waterproof. So it was not the best exploring, but it is quite a cool, beautiful area. Lots of like winding streets and alleys that you can kind of just wander and get lost. And lots of good shopping.
Yeah. So Jaffa, or pronounced Yafu, is an ancient port city situated in the south of Tel Aviv. So what happened was Jaffa was the old provincial capital. And this here led to, like you said, lots of winding streets, which you could easily get lost. It became too crowded. And so a series of well-off families decided, you know what, we're going to move out of this here place, Jaffa, and create somewhere. We're going to create a new neighborhood. And this new neighborhood was called Tel Aviv, which means new life or new beginning. So what eventually happened was Tel Aviv got popular and Jaffa declined in popularity. Eventually got a little bit confused in how a new neighborhood is more rich and diverse than the provincial capital. So they merged together, these are two neighborhoods merged together into what we now call Tel Aviv Yafo. So whenever you say Tel Aviv, you're talking about the neighborhood. When you say Yafo, you're talking about the neighborhood. When you say Tel Aviv Yafo, you're talking about the entire city, if you will. Now Yafo is famous for a few different things. More notable things are the stories of Jonah and the whale in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The story of mythological Andromeda and Perseus.
Love a good myth.
Love a good myth. And what I love, and if any British people are also listening, Jaffa cakes.
Oranges, the orange steps.
Yes. So Jaffa is famous for its specific variety of oranges called the Jaffa orange, which is used in Jaffa cakes. So my British brethren out there, this is where this is why we have Jaffa cakes. So yeah, there's a few cool things to do in Jaffa since its restoration. It has became a popular tourist attraction with people visiting it as part of Tel Aviv, as we discussed, and as a city of interest in its own. It's a real melting pot of Jewish and Arab populations living and breathing the same closely packed air. You pointed out there's a lot of good shopping to do in Jaffa.
Mm-hmm.
More notably, I would highly suggest going to the flea market. Did you manage to get to the flea market at all?
Yeah, I did the flea market. I did Caramel Market, two.
Yeah.
Yep, that market Caramel as well. Market, yeah. It's just really fun. Like, you walk up the beach and you see this big church, this big like old area off the side of a cliff. It really makes you feel like, oh yeah, I'm in somewhere that has been around for centuries on centuries.
Yeah, so the flea market is a key site. You know, it's got some really unique, interesting sounds and smells in the alleys and the streets because it is this melting point of different cultures and religion. Which makes this here city very unique. You know, the streets are lined with galleries and artists and studios, as well as boutique and craft shops. It's a step back in time, like you've said. So the next place we're going to dive into is Masada. Have you heard of Masada?
I have, but I was there for such a blink of an eye, I didn't make it to Masada. So I'm going to be real jealous while you tell all this part.
I've never actually heard of Masada until I visited Israel. Whenever I booked it as a tour, I thought to myself, I booked it as a joint tour, and I thought to myself, well, why am I going to Masada? What is Masada? But holy damn, it's packed. It like intrigued every part of my interest. So Masada is not only important because it's an ancient fortress occupying a breathtaking strategic location high on a plateau above the Dead Sea, because of its symbolic importance of determination and heroism, which continues to this day with many Israeli soldiers sworn in there. So what happened was this fortress, it was built in the year 30 BC by King Herod, whose architectural feats have left their mark throughout the century. At the beginning of the Great Revolt against Rome in the year 68 AD, the site was conquered by a group of Jewish zealots who essentially didn't want to be ruled by Romans. And Masada became their last stronghold. Now, these here Jewish people, roughly 1,000, they were besieged by these here Roman soldiers. And to this day, you can see the Roman forts and the Roman battlements. And that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason Masada is so symbolic is these Jews, they all committed suicide. 1,000 Jews committed suicide rather than be taken into the custody of the Roman soldiers. And after a Israeli national does their term of national service, they're sworn in Masada.
Yeah, I almost covered the story of that happening, but it's just so dark and sad. Like, it's a really interesting tale of everyone sticking together and taking such a bold stand, but it's just also really sad. Did you feel like a heaviness almost, or?
I didn't, but it is a proper step back into history. Mm-hmm. So although a lot of the fortress is destroyed, what they've done is they've rebuilt a fair bit of it, but they've marked a line to see where the old fortress is and the new fortress, the rebuild is. So you can see the old fortress. It is so well intact. You can see mosaics on the ground and the walls. You can see the remains of the luxurious Western palace. You can see the Jewish ritual baths, storerooms, watchtowers, and the synagogue. As I said, you really do get transported back in time, especially whenever you view all the artifacts that were found in Masada, like storage containers, pottery, scrolls, and coins. And for me, what the most interesting and unique artifact was this here big pit, which was the water was stored, and they excavated it. Obviously there's no water in it anymore, and they found these huge big rocks, like 3 or 4 times the size of a head. For me, it'll be 2 times the size of my head. And people thought they're just rocks, and it turned out they're actually rocks for catapults or trebuchets. And you can see them. And, you know, you can see the old Roman encampments, and you can see where they built a ramp to get into the fort. And you can really put yourself in their shoes. So I went in March, and it was like 33 degrees Celsius. Sorry, people in Fahrenheit, I don't know what that is. But you could just picture being there under siege with 1,000 people, no food, no water, no medicine, you know. But yeah, Masada was really, really interesting to go to. And it does overlook the Dead Sea.
Yeah, there are a lot of really cool tours too that you can do. Like, I was looking at doing a sunrise tour so that you go and you watch the sunrise over the sea.
Yeah, so because Masada is so high, you could easily do that. You can hike Masada, or you can do what I did and just get the, not the zip line. What do you call it? The tram? Not the tram. The zip tram?
Cable car.
That's the one. So you can hike it, or you can get the cable car up. And like you said, you can witness these here views over the Dead Sea. So after Masada, I would suggest going to the Dead Sea, because they're pretty much right beside each other. Now, the Dead Sea is a pretty interesting journey. If you are going to the Dead Sea yourself, please be careful and literally do stick to the roads.
Hmm.
Don't go off the road. Don't go walking. Don't go driving off-road. And this is because of sinkholes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So basically, because of the saltiness of the Dead Sea and the fresh water coming in through the mountains, there's a weird mixture underground, which takes away a lot of the land, which forms sinkholes. There's a lot of geology in it. But anyway, these sinkholes are huge. Like, I mean, they'll swallow cars, no problem. When you're driving down the coast of the Dead Sea, you will see old villages abandoned that are falling into the ground. And that's because sinkholes will just randomly open up and just suck things down. And it's you don't truly understand the scale of them until you are up high, like in Masada, where you can see these huge cuts in the earth of just destruction being sucked into the ground. So please stay on the road. Don't go exploring anywhere that has big signs saying don't go here. It's sinkholes. So going down to the Dead Sea after the little warning monologue, what I found quite interesting was my ears actually popped because of the pressure.
Wow.
The Dead Sea is the lowest point on land on Earth. It's quite a thick area in terms of the atmosphere. It's thick to breathe air. Very salty. So the water is very, very salty. It's so salty that salt won't dissolve in it anymore. Whenever you walk in it, your feet hurt. And I thought to myself, oh, there's a lot of rocks here. And I went in, I dug up some of these here, what I thought to be were rocks, and Cassidy were just big lumps of salt.
Oh,
huge,
gosh.
Big lumps of salt. And as I said, because the water is so salty, it just won't dissolve anymore. Whenever you go into the water, you're told to go in backwards in case you fall. Because if you fall, if that water goes in your mouth, in your nose, or in your eyes, it can do some serious damage. Goes in your eyes, blinds you. Goes in your mouth, you just dries your mouth out and you don't have any saliva. Goes in your nose, it burns. I got a little bit in my nose and for about 10 minutes. Oh, so you're told to go in backwards and you float. We've all heard the story about being in the Dead Sea that it makes you float, but I cannot describe how it makes you float. I presumed it helps you float. But Cassidy, it's not. It's the complete opposite. It makes you not sink.
Do you feel like you were hard, like defying the laws of physics? You're like, how am I doing this right now?
Yeah. It's hard to stand up. You're told not to go on your belly because you can't roll over. Because there's no... It's so buoyant. It's really weird. Really weird. You can literally just lie there and you don't have to walk. You don't have to move your hands. You don't have to move your feet. You're literally still. And it keeps you up, or it keeps you floating. To stand up, you have two options. Option one, someone pushes down on your feet. Option two, you do like a huge, big sit-up to try and get yourself up, which is really, really interesting. So yeah, it's very salty, which is believed to be good for your skin. You can rub your skin with some of the Dead Sea mud. It's so salty that there's no life in the Dead Sea. You will not find fish because the water is just so salty.
Because it can't survive. That's wild.
Because it can't survive.
That sounds really incredible. Yeah, I've always wondered. So you put mud on your face. But then you're not supposed to get the water in your eyes and your nose. How does that work out?
So, the mud, you just go into the ground, just lift up a big, huge, big bit of mud. And it's, you can see like little salt granules in it, and you just rub it onto your skin. But you don't do it too much because you are literally rubbing salt and scratching off your skin. So there's showers whenever you come out to get all the mud off. And it's actually surprisingly cheap. Whenever I went, because of COVID and stuff going on, there wasn't a lot of people there. You can go and bring a barbecue and just chill out there all day because it's a public beach at the end of the day. But you can't just turn up anywhere in the Dead Sea. There's like specific safe zones, if you will, because, as I said, sinkholes and that mud. Like if you, it's kind of like sinky mud. Like if you get stuck in it, it's really difficult to get out. So please do go to an official beach if you're going to the Dead Sea.
And exercise caution.
So the last place we're going to in Israel is Jerusalem, the kingdom of heaven. The old city of Jerusalem is one of the most intense places on earth. At the heart of the Jewish, Islamic, and Christian religions, this 1 kilometer area in the center of Jerusalem is beyond words, and it cannot be missed. The old city is home to the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, the last remaining wall of what once was the Jewish temple, is today the holiest site in the world for Jews. Mm-hmm. Above the Western Walls lies the Dome of the Rock, which is important for Muslims as the site where the Prophet Muhammad was thought to rise to heaven. And just a few minutes away from the Dome of the Rock and the Western Wall lies the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I can't pronounce that. And this is where it's believed that the Lord Jesus Christ was crucified and buried. So within this 1 kilometer area, you have three of the holiest sites in all the religions, the main religions, sorry.
That's amazing.
And that is, it's astronomically amazing because there's lots more. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, obviously I'm Christian, so I did the Christian sites, and we'd be here all day naming all the Christian sites. There's about 40 different Christian sites, and it's really interesting how me going as a pilgrim, if you will, is, you know, with the thought of rekindling my religion and seeing people just living their everyday lives. Now, although Jerusalem is a very mixed area, it is divided into four quarters. There's the Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and Armenian quarter. The Jewish, Christian, and Armenian quarter have about 2,000 people living in them each, whereas the Muslim quarter has about 20,000 people living in it. So it's very, very densely packed in the Muslim area. Each quarter has its own atmosphere and observations and sights and smells and experiences. Now, there is some quarters that you're allowed into all the quarters, but obviously you're pretty much taking a step into someone else's, you know, religion and culture. So be sensible whenever you go into each area. There are places that you're not allowed to go depending on what your religion is and depending on what clothes you're wearing. So once again, please go with a guided tour. But I went to the Wailing Wall. I went to the Holy Sepulchre, where I seen Jesus was crucified and where he was buried. And for me, that was just, I can't use the words to describe it. I also did the Via Dolorosa. For people who don't know, that's the Jesus walk that Jesus would have taken whenever he was being, you know, walked to the cross. And, you know,
I just got chills.
Although I'm trying to not, you know, make this recording or this podcast a, you know, a preachy sermon, you can experience all this sort of stuff without religion. You don't have to be religion to see the culture or to see the history or to see and acknowledge where these three religions stem from.
Mm-hmm.
This 1 kilometer, it's small, 1 kilometer area is just so packed, and it's just mind-blowing. Now, although those are some of the things that I would suggest you do in Israel, of course, there's a fair few more. You can go to Bethlehem, but please do 100% get a tour guide because you're crossing the border there. You can go to Jericho, which is the oldest, or one of the oldest cities known to man. The River Jordan, although literally half of it is on Jordan and the other half is on Israel, the River Jordan is where Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. And then Nimrod Fortress, if you're interested in relatively modern history with the Crusaders. There's a lot of Crusader history in Israel because of the Crusades and the Holy Land and stuff like that. So I hope you enjoyed my talk on Israel, and hopefully you've got some inspiration, some of the things that you would like to go to or at least experience in Israel.
It sure makes me want to go back. There's so much I want to see there that I didn't get to. And it's just so beautiful and pretty and green.
Yeah, I'm sure we can go back. COVID and stuff going down, you know, we've traveled a fair bit. You know, people, you'd be able to get to yourself to Israel. So thank you very much for listening to my little ramble about Israel and some of the amazing things you do in Israel. As always, we need to add in the murder part to our podcast. You've experienced the travel. Let's go over to Cassidy. And she's going to intrigue us with some... What are you going to intrigue us with this time?
I just love how you always intro me as, here's some murder. It's not all murder.
Here's the murderer girl. She's the murder one. I'm the fun, hip one.
See everything. Let's go hear about something horrible. Yeah, so like we chatted about, it was a tricky week for me. I don't know if it's because if everything's just in Hebrew or maybe Israel's just really safe. I'm not really sure. There was a fair bit of paranormal things that I thought maybe I could talk about. Tried to find some shipwrecks because I thought that might be interesting. But anyways, after all of that digging, I ended up with a couple of cryptids. So we're going to dig into some cryptozoology this week.
So what is a cryptid?
Cryptozoology looks at the study of animals that are rumored to exist, and then those creatures are called cryptids.
Okay, so like Bigfoot and Yeti and Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah, so just like those, the Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, kind of like the biggest known cryptids. Apparently the gorilla, the giant squid, and the okapi used to be known as cryptids. And now they're like recognized by science and considered real creatures, which I thought was interesting. So we're going to look into two cryptids this week. I tried to pick something a little bit shorter because I thought that you were going to go long with your passion for Israel because there is so much to cover. I apologize if you were really hoping for some heavy hitting crime this week. I will deliver next week. I promise these stories are good too, but it might be a little quicker than you were hoping for. So we're going into the Behemoth and the Leviathan, and they are both in the Book of Job, which is also kind of cool that like the Bible talks about these giant monsters. The Book of Job, presumably written during the second millennium BC, details the events of Job's life. And at the end of the book, God gives a speech to Job describing two large animals. The first animal is described in 10 verses, and the second one is described in 34 verses. So there's two big emphases where he is just diving in onto these animals. So people have questioned whether they actually are real animals. There's different interpretations, whether they're myths, whether they're realistic. Some people believe that they're more along the lines of actual animals that we know today, and they just didn't really have like the right words for them back in the time when the Bible was written in the second millennium. Other people are like, nope, these are cryptids. So I thought that they would be fun for us to dive into.
Okay. So, it's quite interesting these are cryptids, especially that they're mentioned in the Book of Job. You think Bigfoot, you think Loch Ness Monster. So I'm quite interested in what you've managed to wrangle out of a holy scripture.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Behemoth is mostly equated with an elephant. The Leviathan is usually associated with a whale, or people look at the Behemoth and think of the hippopotamus, and the Leviathan with the crocodile. One is a land animal and the other is a water animal. So we're looking at the Behemoth first. In Job chapter 40, God describes the Behemoth as a masterpiece, and the description he gives is about twice as long as the animals in the chapter. Job is asked to consider the behemoth as an animal that eats grass like an ox, so we can assume it's some kind of herbivore. And he's urged to pay attention to the power of its loins and the strength of its belly muscles in verse 16. It is said to have the bones of bronze, limbs of iron, and a tail like a cedar tree. It lives in the marshes and rivers. It's not afraid of anything, and it is the first among the works of God. So like I said, people usually take that description and think of a hippopotamus, but a hippopotamus is, you can't see the loins, and neither are the muscles of a hippopotamus visible. And a hippo is a thick-set animal, doesn't have the bones or limbs of bronze and iron. So they're thinking that maybe it's like a rhetorical expression to describe the animal's power. Some authors think that perhaps someone in Israel didn't have enough knowledge of the hippopotamus, but it actually was a hippo because remains of hippos have been found in Tel Dor in Israel. So it's likely that there were a lot of hippos throughout Israel all the way to the Iron Ages. So when God is describing this behemoth animal in the book of Job, they're like, okay, this sounds like this animal we do know, but we don't really know. And that's a behemoth. So that's the land animal side of our cryptids. The second one that we're moving into is kind of the sea monster, which is the Leviathan. And it is actually found in the Bible 5 times by name, 4 times in the Old Testament verses in King James. And it is described in Job, Psalm twice, and Isaiah. Are you ready for the description of the Leviathan?
I am. I'm intrigued.
In Job 41, the Leviathan is described as the greatest creature in the sea. Unlike a fish, it was useless to try to catch one of these animals with hooks or harpoons because nothing on earth is his equal. It is a creature without fear.
Does it give any visual details of it?
A little bit. So it's meant to have a really large size, some strong jaws, great teeth, a fast swimming ability, and it has a protected back and underside. So a lot of people think that it was a Kronosaurus.
Kronosaurus? I've never even heard of a Kronosaurus. I was going to say a crocodile.
Yes. So usually people think dinosaur or crocodile, but it's meant to be the greatest, most overwhelming animal ever to swim the seas, and was reptile-like with great sharp teeth.
Okay. So this what I find quite interesting about, you know, these cryptids, like you're saying, is this is 2,000 years ago, roughly. This, you know, this is plausible. These animals, you know, there's animals go extinct all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is plausible. There's animals then that just don't exist, aren't around anymore. And looking at this here, Kronosaurus, it is a mixture between like a crocodile and a shark and seal at the same time. So it's completely plausible.
That paired with the fact that like there's so much of the ocean we just haven't explored. So
yeah, well, we know more about the surface of the moon than we do our own oceans.
The depths of the oceans. Yeah. In biblical times, the Leviathan was often associated with evil. Some scholars thought it was to represent the force of chaos, which I kind of love. Today, the word is synonymous with any large aquatic creature. Many researchers believe the sightings during biblical times were the earliest reports of sea monsters. So they're kind of thinking any large ocean creature that they saw, whether it be a whale or, you know, a shark, they're like, oh, it's a sea monster. Oh, it's a Leviathan. They think it might've been like a one-use label that they just kind of slapped on all the monsters, which is why it comes up a lot more than the behemoth in scripture. The argument for the Nile crocodile supports the theory of the Leviathan being the same animal because they're both aquatic, scaly, and have fierce teeth. In Job 41:18, it says that the Leviathan's eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, which is kind of something that a lot of people give to the crocodile's eyes because they rise out of the water before its head. So it kind of gives that image of a sun over a horizon, which I thought was kind of beautiful imagery for a scary animal.
Yeah, to describe, I mean, it makes sense. It's the rise of the sun. Yeah, it's quite interesting. How you couldn't describe a crocodile, a potential crocodile, is something so beautiful as that.
During early European sea exploration, sailors would say the Leviathan was a sea serpent, which would devour ships by swimming around the vessels so quickly that it would cause a whirlpool, which would suck the ship down and bring the crew to its death.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
The main report that we have comes from a North Atlantic wartime captain. So there is a German submarine during World War One that had a sighting of the so-called Leviathan, we think.
World War One, yeah, 1418. Well, 100 years ago, over 100 years ago.
Captain George von Forstner described the saying on July 30th, 1915, our U-28 torpedoed a British steamer called the Iberian, which carried a rich cargo to the North Atlantic. The steamer sank quickly, the bow sticking almost vertical in the air. When it gone down, there was a violent explosion about 25 seconds after. When the pieces of the wreckage were flying about, we saw a giant sea animal writhing and struggling wildly shot out of the water to a height of 60 to 100 feet, which we know is 10 basketball hoops. At that moment, I had with me in the tower my officers of the watch, the chief engineer, the navigator, and the helmsman. We all drew one another's attention to this wonder of the seas and were unable to identify it. We didn't have the time to take a photograph, for the animal sank out of sight after 10 to 15 seconds. It was about 60 feet long, which is huge, and was crocodile-like in shape with four limbs, like powerful webbed feet with a long tail tapering to a point. How scary.
Yeah, that's huge. 60 feet, that's roughly 10 meters, 20 meters. I can't do conversion. Yeah, that's only the length of the log. You can imagine the width and the weight of it. Yeah, that'd be pretty scary to see.
Can you imagine the mixture of emotions? Like, you're doing your job, you're at war, which is scary in itself, and then you're sunk a vessel, so you're like, cool, we're in open waters. Not cool. We're in open waters, we're safe. And then all of a sudden you see this terrifying monster. Watch Jerusalem published an article about the identity of the sea creature, saying that erosion maybe has given us some more information for another explanation. One of the more interesting descriptions about what the Leviathan came from is thought to maybe be this paleontological site in Southwest Egypt called the Wadi al-Hittain, which name means Valley of the Whales. So it's this dry desert that is strewn about with these gigantic skeletons of ancient whales.
Okay, yeah, I've heard about that, actually. These are huge, like you've said. Shows the spine of whales and stuff like that. They're absolutely huge.
Yeah, so over thousands of years, erosion has revealed these creatures, and they're thinking that maybe one of these is the Leviathan. And they kind of describe that in this area, they have found the king lizard called the Basilosaurus. And they're kind of thinking that maybe the Leviathan is one of these skeletons, because there is a scripture in the Psalms that illustrates not only the beast, but also a setting that is quite similar to this wadi. It says that thou didst crush the heads of the Leviathan, thou didst give him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. And that's in Psalm 74:14. They're wondering if the psalm was written by an author who came about a setting kind of like the skeleton graveyard where like there was the skull of a sea creature kind of strewn about in the wilderness. The original meaning of the Hebrew word Leviathan denotes something breath twisted in folds and serpentine in nature. Yet it was not just a serpent, as Job 41:12 describes, limbs and commonly proportioned, which is something that would match the limbed yet extremely long and serpentine Basilosaurus. Like I said, so they're thinking maybe it was this dinosaur that was in this wadi. Verse 22 describes the creature having a powerful neck, which snakes, squids, and whales are not really known for, but the Basilosaurus did have. So perhaps when it was first discovered, the Basilosaurus was thought to be a gigantic reptile, which is why it was named the King Lizard. But after they looked more into it, they saw that it had an incredibly long snake-like creature reaching lengths of 21 meters, which is about 70 feet, and is one of the largest creatures known in the post-dinosaur era. At the front end of that snaking spine was a skull 1.5 meters long, and the teeth had a bite force of 3,600 pounds per square inch.
Oh, that was sure to do some damage. Yeah. Not going anywhere near that.
So that snake-like appearance would give the biblical description of the Leviathan a match, because in Isaiah 27:1, it describes the creature as serpentine, using the Hebrew word nahash, which is the same word used for the snake in the Garden of Eden. And the verse describes it as bending or twisting, serpent and a dragon in the sea. Okay, interesting, perhaps. Most likely candidate.
I think there's a lot to take in. There's a lot of ifs. There's a lot of possibilities. You just gotta sit down and try and work out where the shoe fits. And I think it's a highly plausible cryptid to be real.
Yeah. So on top of that long list of questions, like you said, all those ifs, I ask you a new question. Would the Bible include these giant creatures? And why would a full chapter of Job be dedicated to this animal? Most scholars believe that the context is because God was trying to teach a lesson in humility, describing that a mortal man is no match for these mighty monsters of monsters. Because man didn't create it, he cannot stand before it. But it is nothing compared to the mighty God who created these giant monsters.
Oh, okay.
So that idea that no mortal man would stand a chance against a 20-meter Basilosaurus, yet God is capable of plucking it from the water and leaving its bones scattered across a desert.
Yeah, so this, Job, Old Testament is where God was fire and brimstone and the Almighty, don't mess with me kind of thing. So it makes sense that God's like, you know what, this thing can destroy you, and I just look at it and it's instantly destroyed, so don't mess with me. I wouldn't see that. I wouldn't expect to see that in the New Testament, though. Yeah.
So hippo, crocodile, Basilosaurus, dinosaur, giant squid, whatever your explanation for it is, it stands to say it's in the Bible, covers a couple verses, it's in there for you to dig into. But yeah, we still cannot explain the behemoth and the Leviathan. And that is this week's story on cryptids.
Well, thank you very much. Definitely interesting to hear about something other than crime or murder. Cryptids, I feel, a little bit more of a lighthearted topic, which really gets the brain thinking. And I think it adds to the lighter side of what we can dive into in the podcast. So hopefully our viewers enjoyed it as well and had a little bit of a brain ponder. So thank you very much.
Yeah, it caters more towards the paranormal side, but I had fun doing the Loch Ness Monster way back when, so I thought it'd be fun to dive back into some cryptozoology, and we'll come back around. There'll always be some more crime waiting for us on the other episode. Thanks for tuning in to Israel. I hope that you have skyrocketed it to the top of your must-see destinations, because it really is quite a special place. We'll see you at our next destination somewhere around the world.
On behalf of the flight crew, thank you for flying with us and have a pleasant day.